Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York is celebrating a solar energy milestone as it continues to work toward its goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 85% by 2050. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons with more.
Leaders are gathered on a fall morning in a field filled with solar panels. And if things go according to plan, this will be an even more common sight in the years to come. 6 gigawatts of distributed solar has now been installed across the state, a year ahead of schedule. That's according to New York State Energy Research and Development Authority President and CEO Doreen Harris. She says the initiative is funded through the state's $3.3 billion New York Sun Initiative and will power more than 1 million homes and businesses.
It's truly representative of the really what a goal can do, which can move a market toward an objective, and we're pleased today to celebrate just that. We continue many aspects of our work toward other aspects of our climate law goals. Certainly the world has changed since 2019 in significant ways. I think we've made smart decisions to move these markets forward, but to prioritize affordability at the same time.
NYSERDA is working to reach 10 gigawatts by 2030. Speaking with reporters in New Scotland Thursday, Harris says 3.4 gigawatts of the remaining 4 are already in development. The Environmental Protection Agency says distributed solar is generated and stored at or near where it will be used. Harris says it has generated more than $9 billion in private investments.
As I say, there is nothing but upside when one looks at the load growth that we're seeing on our state. That means the numerator of our 70 by 30 equation gets larger, and ultimately this market will only continue to have upside.
The distributed solar project in New Scotland will generate 6.7 million kilowatt hours of solar energy annually, powering 1,000 low-income households. Earlier this year, NYSERDA received $250 million in funding through the EPA's Federal Solar for All program. State Public Service Commission Chair Rory Christian says climate change is in the hands of regulators.
Every kilowatt hour we produce through solar and other renewables is a kilowatt hour we avoid producing through fossil fuels.
Assemblywoman Pat Fahey is a Democrat from the 109th District who's running for state Senate. She says her New York Home Energy Affordable Transition Act, better known as the New York Heat Act, would ensure clean energy transitions are affordable and reliable for middle-class families. The bill stalled in the last session. The measure would rescind what's known as the 100-foot rule, which requires that utility ratepayers subsidize gas hookup installations within 100 feet of a home or business. It also caps utility bills for low-income New Yorkers and makes it easier for gas companies to help customers convert to energy-saving devices like heat pumps. Republicans in the legislature oppose the effort. Fahey says such laws would help the state continue on a path to meet its energy goals.
That has been quite controversial because that too is ambitious. And I often say, whether bills make it or not, it gives us, it lays out a plan, it lays out goals, and it helps focus and it helps amplify the conversation on what we need to do and reminds us that we need to keep reaching.
The state climate plan also requires all new passenger cars and some trucks to be zero emission by 2035. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
New York State colleges and universities, and some private ones too, are waiving application fees right now. That's in an effort to make college more accessible to New York families, but also to boost enrollment in higher education, which has been on the decline. The New York Public News Network's Amy Feiereisel with more.
Until November 3rd, the State University of New York is waiving up to 5 application fees per student to its 64 colleges and universities. SUNY Chancellor John King says the goal is to get students exploring their higher education options.
If you want a big school, we've got University of Buffalo with 30,000 students. If you want a small liberal arts college, we've got SUNY Geneseo. If you're passionate about the environment, we've got our Environmental Science and Forestry College in Syracuse.
King says they also want to get the message out about financial aid and the cost of state schools.
We find that when students begin the application process, that may be the first time they and their families realize that our tuition at our 4-year campuses is only $7,070 for the year. 52% of our students actually go tuition-free because of the federal Pell Grant program and the New York State Tuition Assistance Program.
Alongside the SUNY system and the City University of New York, over 50 private universities are also waiving their application fees in October. It's part of a nationwide trend to remove application barriers. That's in the face of declining enrollment in higher education, which King says the SUNY system has been grappling with.
Last year, we saw our first enrollment increase in a decade.
Since 2010, the number of students enrolling in college in the U.S. has been on a steady decline, about a 1.5% drop per year. Enrollment also took a hit when the U.S. Department of Education revamped the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA, last fall. Technical issues with the new form led to millions of students not being able to apply. That meant a huge delay in knowing whether they could afford to go to college. That had a big impact, says SUNY Chancellor King.
Nationally, there's no question that there were students who were negatively impacted. In New York, we were down about 11% statewide in FAFSA completion.
King says the SUNY system made a lot of efforts this spring and summer to make up for the federal FAFSA challenges. That included paying current SUNY students to provide FAFSA guidance to high schoolers.
Although we think we were able to mitigate the impact for SUNY, we still worry about the students who may have missed out on knowing how much financial aid is out there for them.
In removing fees and through related in-person and virtual events to help students with their applications, King hopes to inspire high schoolers to apply who maybe wouldn't have.
To say, you know what, I'm going to apply to college. And so this could be the opening of a door. We want SUNY to be a path to upward mobility for New Yorkers all across the state.
Applications are free until November 3rd for SUNY schools. Applications at private universities are free until the end of October or have been waived year-round. Amy Feiereisel for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. This week, I sat down with Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. We spoke about a 2022 law that would allow college students to vote on campus.
Yeah, you know, I have to admit this is definitely in the hair pulling out of my head category. The law, which was relatively straightforward, you're right, was approved in the budget that passed in 2022. It was actually in place for the 2022 election cycle. And we looked at the student voter turnout. I mean, the Albany Times Union did an analysis showing 18 to 24-year-old turnout, and it really hadn't budged at all. And so we got interested in this to see what had happened. And we found that at a lot of the schools that the way that college student voter registration was occurring was done in a way that we thought didn't really register voters. And so we decided to look again in advance of the 2024 election cycle to see how the law was being implemented. And so there's two sets of data here. One is there's a list of polling places that are produced by the State Board of Elections for the primary election in June. And then there's a list that's put in place for the general election in November. And generally speaking, they're more or less the same, of course, but there can be differences. So we looked in, as you mentioned, in May, we put out an analysis in May of 2024, and we found there was a whole bunch of places that, you know, could have had polling places on college campuses but didn't. We then sent that to the State Board of Elections and said, please review and let us know if there's a problem. We never heard anything back. We sent a follow-up letter in July saying, don't forget, we're looking at this because we know your list is coming out soon for the general. And then we did a follow-up analysis that came out earlier this month. And in both cases, there are colleges and universities that a reasonable person would assume should have polling places, and they don't. And what the State Board of Elections said after this most recent analysis is that none of the ones that we identified, zero, had the requisite number of registered voters on campus. And not to make this a ridiculously long story, what we had assumed in our most recent analysis was that if a college had at least 1,000 students, had dorms, and then didn't have a polling place within a mile, that would be a college that the state board should be looking at. What they say is that in all cases, there weren't 300 registered voters on the college campus, which to us seems mind-boggling, given how many students there are on each one of those, at least 1,000. And some of them have thousands of students that go to the school, many of whom live on campus.
That's Blair Horner, Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Election day is around the corner, and the candidates for Congress in New York's 18th district faced off in a bitter debate this week. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King was there and filed this report.
What we're going to do now is do a cross-examination where you each ask each other a question. And we're going to start with Allison Esposito asking Pat Ryan a question. Go ahead.
Congressman Pat Ryan and Republican Allison Esposito sparred on everything from abortion rights to the cost of living in a debate hosted by Spectrum News. Esposito accused Ryan, a Democrat seeking a second full term, of not doing enough to lift the federal government's cap on state and local tax deductions for New Yorkers, while Ryan targeted Esposito for taking money from utility lobbyists.
You need to explain that to the voters of the district.
Pat Ryan, it's the lack of integrity in almost all of his statements is absolutely ridiculous. First of all, the Green New Deal and the attack on energy is what's hiking up our energy bills, and it's absolutely ludicrous. We could be diversifying.
The 18th district includes parts of Orange, Dutchess, and Ulster counties. It's a seat Democrats are hoping to maintain as they seek to flip the House. Polling by Emerson College put Ryan 5 percentage points ahead of Esposito earlier this month. Esposito is a retired deputy with the New York City Police Department and a former candidate for lieutenant governor. The first topic of the night focused on a frequent subject of her campaign, immigration. Esposito said the influx of asylum seekers at the southern U.S. border is a security threat and a drain on sanctuary cities like New York City.
What we need is to reinstate the Remain in Mexico policy. We need a secure southern border, and then they need to follow the ports of entry and not be paroled into the country where we don't know who they are.
Ryan said he agrees more needs to be done at the southern border, but it'll only happen with a bipartisan approach. He touted the Dignity Act, a bill he co-sponsored with some House Republicans last year, which would increase personnel at the border while boosting the availability of work visas for immigrants.
This is the difference between pointing out a problem and working in good faith in a bipartisan way, which is what I've been doing the last 2 years, to try to fix the problem.
The bill has yet to pass either chamber of Congress. Ryan repeatedly brought up Esposito's support of former President Donald Trump, while Esposito tied Ryan to President Joe Biden. Ryan was one of the first congressional Democrats to call on Biden to step down from the presidential race this summer after Biden's poor performance in a debate against Trump. Ryan described it as an instance of putting patriotism before party.
I was hearing from constituents across the district that they were concerned about two things. One, the existential threat that Donald Trump poses to our democracy, and we saw this a few years ago on January 6th, and two, the ability for Joe Biden to prosecute that case fully and forcefully against Donald Trump.
Do you want to respond to
that? So again, this is the left rhetoric that actually got Donald Trump shot and shot at. They call him an existential threat to democracy, yet he usurped 14 million Democrat voters that voted for Joe Biden. Not one voted for Kamala Harris to be the top of the ticket. And the reason wasn't patriotism. The reason was he saw he was going to lose an election. They saw that Donald Trump was going to be back in the White House, and they couldn't handle that.
Asked if she thinks Trump was mentally fit to serve as president, Esposito said yes. On the subject of abortion rights, Esposito said she agrees with the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, but that she wouldn't support a federal abortion ban. Ryan said overturning Roe stripped half of Americans of their bodily rights, and that he would consider eliminating the filibuster in the Senate to push through legislation codifying abortion rights nationwide. He won his first race for Congress in a special election just after that 2022 decision.
We're seeing the Senate, on a bunch of issues, including protecting reproductive freedom, fail to 70% of the American people support this policy. So I think that has to be on the table, and that's not something I say lightly.
Ryan also repeated his support of Proposition 1, a ballot measure in New York that would prohibit discrimination based on age, gender, sexuality, and reproductive health outcomes, including abortion. Esposito is one of multiple Republican candidates who have falsely claimed the amendment would allow boys to play on girls' sports teams or allow transgender youth to seek gender-affirming care without their parents' consent.
Allison said abortion is not on the ballot. It is literally on the ballot in New York. So please flip over your ballots and vote to protect reproductive freedom here in New York State.
So abortion's not even in Proposition 1, outcome of pregnancy is, which isn't at job interviews. I am going to be voting against Proposition 1. And as a member of the gay community, it's not about LGBTQ rights. It's about fairness in sports, security in locker rooms, and it is about allowing parents to decide what's best for their children.
Election Day is November 5th. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
The Adirondack Council has issued its latest State of the Park report, reviewing government actions and the status of the 6 million acres of protected lands in the state. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
The report traditionally gives thumbs up or down on actions taken by the governor and legislature, the courts, the Adirondack Park Agency, and the Department of Environmental Conservation, and local and federal government. Among the ratings in this edition of the report, Governor Kathy Hochul received more praise than criticism. She was given thumbs up for eventually funding items such as clean water grants and the Environmental Protection Fund. But she was chastised for not nominating candidates to serve on the Adirondack Park Agency Board. The state legislature received mostly good grades, but failed regarding finding new uses for closed prisons and addressing lack of cell phone coverage across the Adirondacks. John Sheehan is the report author.
We had some progress on clean water and also on wastewater treatment facilities, and a big move forward in how affordable those things are inside the Adirondack Park, in that the state has now doubled the amount of money available for grants for wastewater treatment facilities. So that is a big deal because it means both better facilities, cleaner water in the Adirondacks, but it also means lower taxes. This will mean good things for the economy in the Adirondacks, and long term, protecting water is always a good idea.
Adirondack Mountain Club Interim Executive Director Julia Gorin says the State of the Park is a comprehensive document that reviews a number of issues.
There was a lot to celebrate this year. So many different successes like the governor's budget and the support from the legislature to really protect our public lands and to make sure that there's money for stewardship and money for issues like diversity.
Adirondack Wild Friends of the Forest Preserve managing partner David Gibson says his group is aligned with the details in the report, but he feels that it could provide a longer-term assessment of the park.
I always say this in a friendly tone to the council, that there's so many thumbs up and thumbs down that sometimes the whole forest gets missed with the trees, and the larger picture sometimes can get lost. It's a very positive report in many ways. It does shine a spotlight on a myriad of important matters facing the Adirondack Park, and the North Country. But my interest is in the larger picture.
Gorin notes that one of the key issues in the report that will continue to be a concern is the visitor use management planning for state lands in the Adirondacks.
We expect to see recommendations be put forth by the Department of Environmental Conservation looking at management of the recreational use of the High Peaks. And how the department proceeds with this, I think, is going to be crucial in thinking about recreation, of visitor experience, of local economies, and most importantly, of our wilderness experiences and the natural resources of this area.
The report has been issued annually for 43 years, and Sheehan has authored it for 33 years.
Primarily when I first started, acid rain was the greatest threat to the park, but climate has taken a much bigger role. It is impossible to ignore now, and something that I think we're taking much more seriously than we did, say, 30 years ago. At the same time, road salt has become much more prevalent in our work, and I think that continuing to work on water quality will be something that is probably the common element that runs through the whole period.
The Adirondack Council will celebrate its 50th anniversary in 2025.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Schuylerville residents recently celebrated the turning point of the American Revolution, almost 250 years later. The Legislative Gazette's Erin Shella Levine with more.
October 17th marks Surrender Day in the Saratoga County Village. British General John Burgoyne led his troops to surrender against the Continental Army in 1777. It ended the British attempt to control the Hudson River Valley, and the victory secured French support of the colonies.
So it was a day like this in 1777. The British had a horrible stay in Saratoga. It was a week of wet. They were cold, they were miserable, they didn't have enough supplies, so they were hungry. They described horses going around looking like living skeletons. And then today is similar because on October 17, 1777, it was a bright sunny day.
Town of Saratoga historian Sean Kelleher is wearing a blue and white cotton coat and tricorn hat, dressed as American General Horatio Gates. He's standing on the banks of Fort Hardy Park, and the morning fog is still lifting off the Hudson behind him.
It's very special because this is how we build stewards for our community. It's real. The battles of Saratoga is considered the turning point of the American Revolution. It's one of the most significant battles in world history. But as Americans, what makes it really important is that the Declaration of Independence was just words on a piece of paper until it was made a great fact here at Saratoga, where the first time a complete British army surrendered. So it's great that we're celebrating this in this community, and our plans are to just improve the celebrations, especially as we head towards our 250th anniversary.
The Capital Region and the Northeast at large are planning for an increase in heritage tourism as the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution approaches. The nearby Saratoga National Historical Park drew more than 100,000 visitors in 2023, and county leaders continue to fund 250th anniversary initiatives. Groups of students are walking from the Schuylerville Central School just down the road. Saratoga County historian Lauren Roberts wants to expand today's program to more schools.
It's an experience. It's being on the ground where history happened. It's out of the classroom. It's looking at the Hudson River behind you and knowing that a really important world event happened here. So if you can impress upon kids at a young age, it's here because people that came before them have preserved it, and that's what we want to impress upon them, that now it's our turn and the legacy continues, right? Depending on how they feel and how they treat their history, if they're proud of where they're from, and what happened here, if they continue to tell the stories and learn more about it, then it helps history going forward.
The program includes speeches from local officials and students, 13 apple cider toasts,
freedom to the whole world,
a reenactment of the surrender,
he returned my sword, but he's keeping my army,
and a live cannon. It's one of teacher Peter Carner's favorite days of the year. He's a history buff.
I was going to say the kids love the cannon, obviously. But for these guys, and seeing the people reenact in their attire, having the kids come in with the muskets really puts it into perspective and puts it real for them. So it's not just something they read about in books. They're seeing it and talking to the people. So that makes it real life. It's very easy to teach fourth grade history in Schuylerville.
His students have a harder time picking their favorite part of the morning.
The shooting the cannons and singing.
Shooting the cannons.
Yeah, I like for me it was for me it was either drumming or the cannons.
The campaign for Saratoga 250 is unveiling an educational kiosk at Tribal Park in Ballston Spa October 26th.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello Levine. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2443. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.